This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It's common practice in Sicily to pay the mafia to not burn your business down. But some young Italians are refusing to play along.
Emiliano Rocchi is the chef at Portella della Ginestra's restaurant. He's not going to kiss the ring of any mafioso.
And in India, a campaign to fight bribery tries another tack.
It resembles the 50 rupee note in the Indian currency. It is printed with the number zero and the word 0 rupees in the middle of the note. Give me
fire, give me and we'll explore World Cup soccer music.
See the champions take the field now. Unify us, make us feel proud. In the streets, our heads are
around the world with the World Vision Report. First, this news.
Celebration, it surrounds us.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Aid has been flowing into Haiti in droves since the January earthquake. Most of it's been delivered by international humanitarian aid groups like the Red Cross. But Haitians living abroad are doing their best to send money and supplies home. In Boston, Haitian cargo ships pick up hundreds of used cars and trucks, a lot of them clunkers. Haitian Americans are shipping them home to relatives and friends. Others are sold in Port-au-Prince for profit. But are America's cast-off vehicles the kind of help Haiti needs right now? Chris Burrell reports from the Boston waterfront.
Dump trucks, SUVs, school buses, and cars rumble across a blacktop pier on Boston Harbor. They clatter over a steel ramp and disappear into the dark hold of a cargo ship called the Caligaldana that will soon depart for Haiti. But some vehicles are in such bad shape they need a shove from a couple men with strong legs or a tow truck to get them on board. Gaping rust holes and dead batteries are commonplace. Several have smashed windshields and no brakes. Some developing countries limit the age of imported vehicles, but Haiti has no such policy. There's also no official count on the numbers of used vehicles exported to Haiti. But Haitian Americans and expats around Boston send enough used cars and trucks back to their home country to fill a cargo ship every 6 to 7 weeks, almost 1,000 used vehicles a year.
We need the Mack truck, the water tank, and the truck behind it, and then tow the other two.
That's Renal Pierribia, a Haitian American who works for the shipping company that handles the exports from Boston. As he barks orders to the tow truck driver, a red and black dump truck lumbers by with mattresses, used tires, and old bicycles peeking out from under a green plastic tarp.
Well, first of all, you got to understand, when these people send those cars, they send them with food to feed their own family, and also they send it with stuff that they could sell, like used clothing, stereos, electronics equipment.
It's my toolbox. I need it in Haiti.
In a parking lot near the pier, Joseph Renner rummages through his toolbox. He's shipping a 79 Ford flatbed truck, but it doesn't have a key, so he needs to hotwire it to get it on the ship. The front end of the truck also has big holes in it, but Renner isn't the least bit phased. It'll all be fixed up once it reaches Haiti.
It's going to be a new truck. It's going to be a new truck. When it's been 18, they're just going to make it new. That's why I bought it.
Renna's older brother will be waiting for the truck. The two men fix up trucks and sell or rent them from a yard they own outside Port-au-Prince. Renna is definitely part of a trend. Since the earthquake, more big trucks and trailers and fewer cars are heading to Haiti.
You see, like, for they say it's going to take 10 years to clean that.
They say it's going to take 10 years to clean up Port-au-Prince, he says. That's why they need the truck. A lot of trucks were lost in the earthquake. His logic is sound, says Robert Lawrence, a professor of international trade at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
It's a win-win situation. What is cheap in Haiti is labor. And so skilled people in Haiti, mechanics and so on, can afford to fix these cars up. It does work out to Haiti's advantage, and actually it works out to the advantage of those who are selling them.
But others say there's a cost to shipping so many old cars and trucks to Haiti. Alex Cantave is a Haitian American who teaches public policy at the University of Massachusetts at Boston.
my fellow diaspora Haitians will kill me for saying this, but I do think that Haiti is becoming a dumping ground for everything that people don't need here. Everything from mattresses to cars. And I really mean it when I say a dumping ground, because half of the stuff that folks are sending down there are trash.
Ketsia Pierre-Louis agrees. She heads up the Chamber of Commerce in a town outside Port-au-Prince called Croix de Bouquet.
You know, the diaspora may say that they're helping. She feels like there's profit there for them.
And she directs most of her disdain at the stuff packed inside the vehicles.
Often they don't work, and people have to find a way to get rid of them, and they are burning plastic. The air is filthy.
Back at the cargo ship, crewmen pull at thick chains and steel bars to lash down close to 100 cars and trucks for the voyage from Boston to the port of Saint-Marc. 8 days and 1,500 nautical miles later, these American exports will roll off the ship and have a chance to prove whether they are good or bad for Haiti's future. For the World Vision Report, I'm Chris Burrell on Boston Harbor.
Chris covered this issue for the Boston Globe Sunday magazine. To read his story, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. When we think of Italy, as some of us do rather longingly at this time of year, we don't usually think poverty, more like Italian sipping Chianti under the Tuscan sun. But for Sicilians, that scene is more like a fairy tale. One-third of Sicilians live below the poverty line. Who's to blame? Many say it's the mafia. For decades, the mafia has had a stranglehold on the economy and the people of the island. But anti-mafia groups are finding creative ways to fight back and make some money at the same time. Nancy Greenlees tells us how.
Annalisa Di Matteo climbs a narrow staircase to reach one of the three bedrooms inside this 18th century farmhouse turned bed and breakfast. The manager reveals a room with an ancient wooden ceiling and then flings open a window. She calls to the hotel's horses, who munch on grass along a distant ridge. Before us, rocky promenades circle a lush valley. Often it's carpeted with scented yellow flowers from the ginestra shrub. This B&B and the land that it sits on are called the Portella della Ginestra, or the gateway to the Ginestra. How sweet it is, says Di Matteo.
La mattina. Magari per chi vive in città.
In the morning, my goodness, one wakes up to this panorama. For people from the city, the silence is a miracle.
But this region has a history that's anything but tranquil. In 1947, peasants gathered in this valley to celebrate May Day. Just as the ceremonies were getting underway, machine gun fire sprayed the crowd. 11 people were killed. Francesco Galante of the anti-mafia group Liberatera says bandits linked with the mafia wanted to send a message to those who dared to ask for farmers' rights.
Fu di fatto la prima strage di stato, la prima.
It was, in fact, the first massacre, the first major act of intimidation against the farmers, the poor. It was their call for a democratic sharing of the land because they wanted to improve their lot in life.
Fearful farmers were silenced, and the mafia swooped in to take over much of the fertile Sicilian countryside. Land is power, and the mafia has a monopoly on it. In the 1970s, the late boss Bernardo Brusca took over the Portella della Ginestra. He was convicted in the murders of three police officers in the 1990s and sentenced to life in prison. The government confiscated his land. Under an Italian law, former mafia assets are assigned to cooperatives to help the communities destroyed by these criminals. Libera Terra, or free land, restored the dilapidated farmhouse and grounds. Manager Di Matteo admits that some guests have chosen to leave once they heard about the land's roots.
They were guests who live in the nearby towns. Towns where there's still the mentality that you have to show respect to the mafia, to the bosses.
A person who strikes fear and terror in people is a criminal, period. They don't deserve respect.
Emiliano Rocchi is the chef at Portella della Ginestra's restaurant. He's not going to kiss the ring of any mafioso. Instead, he says he's sending a message by working at a business that has no mob connections.
It's sort of a slap against the mafia.
The 32-year-old, a big fellow dressed in black chef's garb, is busy preparing lunch. He says this hotel, which employs four people, is serving up a new economic model.
It's a business that is self-supporting, that provides work for people, that puts young people to work in honest enterprises instead of criminal ones.
Doesn't sound too unusual, but in Sicily, many business owners pay pizzo. That's mafia extortion money, paid to keep the same mafiosi from setting fire to your business, or worse. The practice of pizzo results in lower salaries and puts a halt on companies' growth, making jobs scarce. The Portella della Ginestra does not pay pizzo, and Chef Rocchi buys ingredients from businesses that refuse to pay it. But to make it into the chef's kitchen, an ingredient needs to be more than mafia-free.
We try to offer the highest quality dishes, because you can boast all you want about being anti-mafia, but it could be a fad.
The Michelin Guide recently praised the hotel and restaurant. But the restaurant's patrons, from tourists to locals, are the real judges. Today's critics are a gaggle of high school students on a field trip focusing on the mafia and anti-mafia efforts. Yes, that topic is actually fodder for a school trip. Now they're getting a taste of clean cuisine as they dig into a plate of fresh ricotta cheese, just made this morning. Until a few years ago, this field trip would have been unheard of. No one spoke of the mafia. Organized criminals demand a code of silence and frame it as an honorable act. Many honest Sicilians abide in order to survive. Teacher Giovanni Grutadaria says these young people have grown up believing that to denounce the mafia is cowardly.
E invece proprio noi dobbiamo cercare di inculcare nelle giovani generazioni questo cambio di.
Instead, we really have to try to change this attitude in the young generation, because they have to feel that they are citizens and therefore have civil rights.
The school teachers predict their pupils will not see the end of the mafia, nor will their children or grandchildren. It will take generations. However, this establishment offers the first course.
È stato un ottimo pranzo.
Pieno di speranza.
It was a delicious lunch, full of hope. It's giving new life to tainted land.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Nancy Greenlace in Sicily.
Later on in the show, Nancy tells us about her meeting with an 81-year-old grandmother who strikes fear in the heart of the mafia. India doesn't have the mafia, but corruption there is rampant.
The average citizen cannot obtain any governmental service or goods from any department whatsoever without having to pay a bribe, either in cash, kind, or using influence in the department.
One man is taking it on. They call him the bribe fighter. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Israel announced a loosening of the Gaza trade embargo last week, and President Obama met with the Israeli Prime Minister to get the peace process moving. Meanwhile, Palestinians remain scattered across the Middle East, just like they have since the creation of Israel in 1948. The Palestinians have a long history of artistic resistance to their plight, from lyrical ballads to graffiti and cartoons. But in the past few years, a new front has opened up. Hip-hop. Don Duncan takes us to Israel, the West Bank, and Lebanon.
At a rap concert in the West Bank, fathers with children on their shoulders bounce to the beat. Clusters of young boys bust gangster signs, and older women clap, albeit with a little confusion, at the hip-hop circus of rappers on stage. District Rhymes Unit raps about its West Bank reality. The group raps about things like Israeli checkpoints and dysfunctional Palestinian governance. Next on stage, Damn. In Arabic, the group's name means to last forever, and it's the oldest and best known of the Palestinian hip-hop groups. What sets it apart is the fact that its members, including Tamer Nofer, live inside Israel itself.
We will talk about how difficult it is to be like a double agent, to live with Israel, you know. It's practically living with the enemy, sleeping with the enemy.
Dam sometimes raps in Hebrew, like in this song called Born Here. It's about the destruction of Palestinian homes that the Israeli government says were built illegally. There is another version of Palestinian rap, Born in Lebanon, where thousands of Palestinians ended up after the creation of Israel in 1948. Camps like this one in Beirut are some of the most crowded places in the world. The estimated 400,000 Palestinians in Lebanon, mostly Sunni Muslims, are seen as a threat to the country's delicate sectarian balance. They have restricted access to education and jobs. Tall, improvised buildings tower over narrow, dark, refuse-strewn alleys, choked with people, bicycles and scooters. Overhead, clumps of electrical wires snake from building to building. For 21-year-old rapper Yassin Qasim, the Burj Al Brezhne camp is all he's ever known. He says he used to envy the freedom of the pigeons that fly above his refugee camp. Now, he sings with them. Yassin started off writing a diary, but then found that hip-hop was the best way for him to talk about his life.
Because in rap you can say whatever you want, you can describe yourself in any word, you don't need to be polite with people, you just need to say what you love, you know?
Yassin raps about things other Palestinians rap about, like statelessness and the war in Gaza. But he also raps about the uniquely atrocious conditions Palestinians in Lebanon experience. Wake up, starting each day with problems for breakfast. Walking in the camp's roads every day, alleys get narrower and narrower. Wake up, if you don't want to stand in line, finish college with a janitor's degree. Like most Palestinian rap groups, Yassin's studio and rehearsal space is in a room in his house. Yassin uses a microphone hooked up to a computer with a sound editing program. When he started to rap, he was met with bemusement and disbelief. Most people he knew thought hip-hop was something that existed on TV and talked about girls, drugs, and fast cars. What are you going to rap about? They asked him. You don't even have a car. But Yassin knew differently.
Hip-hop is not about drugs. Hip-hop is not about cars. Hip-hop is not about girls. Hip-hop about your life and it's to express where you come from. And this is how hip-hop starts in the States.
Yassin says his reality in an urban Palestinian refugee camp has a lot in common with the roots of hip-hop in American ghettos in the 1970s. Both worlds involve poverty, oppression and identity crises. For Yassin, such hardships feed his rap. He quotes from the legendary rapper Tupac Shakur.
Tupac say hip-hop come out of struggle. The more struggle you live, the more you can say.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Don Duncan in the Burj Al Brezhne refugee camp in Beirut, Lebanon.
People in India face corruption at every turn. That's what Vijay Anand says, and he should know. He's the head of Fifth Pillar, an organization devoted to fighting corruption across India. It affects everyone, rich or poor. But Vijay Anand says it's the poor who suffer the most. His group has come up with an interesting tool in the fight against corruption. It's called the Zero Rupee Note.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. Let's start off with the actual problem, which is corruption. We hear about a lot of corruption in the developing world, but how pervasive is corruption in India?
The common man has to deal with it on a daily basis. If you were to obtain a driving license, the governmental fee for obtaining a learner's permit is 60 rupees, whereas a citizen has to pay a bribe of not less than 500 rupees to get the learner's permit, which is like almost close to 10 times of what the governmental fee is.
I would think there are a lot of people who are squeezed out of services because of this. Do they do it to everybody across every class?
Everybody across every class. The price list varies from class to class. If the DMV or the transport office is in a rural district, the price is a little lesser than in the metropolitan cities. But nobody is immune to this. Every citizen has to go through this. Unless you have an uncle or a relative as the topmost official in the department, you don't get to pay the money, but still you get to use the influence. Without that, you cannot get the document or the paperwork done.
Is this something that's just a nuisance to people and they expect for it to happen, or does it really hurt people financially?
It's absolutely a nuisance in that no citizen has had the luxury of getting a certificate or a service on the same day that they walk into an office. And on top of that, it is also a financial burden for the middle class, the lower middle class, and India has a vast majority that is below poverty line. These people cannot afford the bribe, and they are impacted twice. Number one, they cannot afford the money. Number two, they have to wait inordinately until they get the monies in their hand to pay the bribe.
I guess it makes me wonder, this seems to be just something in the culture that's accepted. How did bribes become such a way of life that's accepted?
It started before the independence time. During the freedom struggle in the 19th century and the early 20th century, a particular class of Indians who worked for the British were bribed by the class of Indians that did not work for the British to get the services or the privileges that the British government made available to the people. So it started then, and it has carried on until now.
I see. But your group has come up with a very unusual strategy that seems to be working, and I want to talk about that. It's called the zero rupee note. What is that, and how does it work?
The zero rupee note is a symbol, visual symbol of non-cooperation to corruption and bribery. It resembles the 50 rupee note in the Indian currency, but it is larger in size than the 1,000 rupee note, which is the largest denomination in India. It is printed with the number zero and the word zero rupees in the middle of the note, and the original currency has a pledge that says, I promise to pay the bearer the sum of 50 rupees, whereas the zero rupee note that we have come up with replaces that pledge and states, I promise to neither accept nor give bribe.
But it looks like a 50 rupee note.
That is correct.
How much is that in dollars?
It's close to a dollar. It's probably $1.10.
So how have you seen the zero rupee note be used? Can you give me some stories on ways that it's worked, that you've seen it work?
Sure. There was a 19-year-old college student, a girl by name Marie Sharma. She has encountered a traffic policeman quite a few times in her hometown, and every time she had to shell out 100 rupees or 200 rupees in spite of having all her documents in place. But in spite of that, she has to pay 100 rupees as bribe so that the traffic policeman does not slap her with some out of the ordinary fine. This is what the corrupt government officials in India are used to doing. When Marie Sharma encountered a similar situation after she came to know about Fifth Pillar, our organization, after she had the zero rupee note in her hand, she did not want to pay the bribe, and instead she pulled out the zero rupee note from the box of her two-wheeler, her motorcycle, and handed it out to the traffic policeman, who started blushing. He was in shame. He started blushing, and in her own words, he allowed her to go and even return the zero rupee note to the student.
Let's talk about how this zero rupee note works, because I'm kind of amazed that you can stop officials from asking for bribes just by handing them a note that looks like really 50 rupees but isn't. What is it? What's the dynamic at work here?
Well, there is a law in India. It's called the Prevention of Corruption Act that states that bribery is a crime punishable by jail time for both the giver and the taker. By handing out the zero rupee note to a corrupt official, all you're doing is reminding of that law, reminding him or her of that law.
I would just think all I'd have to say if someone pulled me over and asked for a bribe is, hey, this is against the law. You're asking for a bribe. Why couldn't I do that? How does the zero rupee note enhance the reversal of corruption? Why not just say something to the official?
Well, the Zero Rupee Note also has the name of our organization printed on the front as well as the back of it. And the contact information, including the address, email address, and the phone number, are also printed on the back of the Zero Rupee Note. That makes it known to the corrupt official that the individual standing in front of him or her is not a lone individual. He or she is part of a larger movement, and the organization will come to his or her backing. And that sends a sense of fear and shock. And that is one reason why the Zero Rupee Note takes a powerful shape.
Vijay, how many of these Zero Rupee Notes have been printed?
We have so far printed a little over 1 million copies in the last 4 years. And we have distributed almost 95% of them. We have the last few thousand left. And we don't intend to stop.
How successful has this been?
I wouldn't say we have been able to wipe out corruption in a large scale, but out of the 1 million, close to 1 million notes that we have distributed, we can safely assume that a few thousand have used it, because we have received emails, phone calls, and personal visits to the office from hundreds of people every month telling that they were very successful in getting their job done by just handing out the Zero Rupee Note. So the only question that remains is, how long is it going to take for us to reach out to the entire population of India? The moment we make it widely known to the entire population, we are sure that day-to-day corruption, petty bribes faced by the common man in terms of obtaining fundamental rights can be wiped out in the next 5 to 10 years.
Vijay, I would think that there are many other countries, organizations looking at your campaign. I'm wondering if it's going to expand beyond India.
Absolutely. We have a website called zerocurrency.org that has similar zero currency models of the currencies of almost all the nations of the world. And incidentally, in the last 1 year, we have organizations from Nepal, Mexico, Argentina, Benin in Africa, who have asked to adopt our zero rupee model. And there is a organization called Youth Alliance in Mexico, another organization called ProPublic in Nepal, that have already started using the zero currency in their on their website and in various ways of distributing to the people.
Vijay Anand is the head of the Indian group called Fifth Pillar. Vijay, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Peggy.
We heard a little earlier that Sicilians are wrestling with corruption too, but in the form of the mafia. Business owners there have to pay the mafia extortion money. It's called pizzo. And the deal is this: if you pay the money, the mafia won't set fire to your business or threaten your family. The word pizzo in Sicilian means the beak of a chicken. That's because the mafia pokes at businesses, taking a little money each month, just like a chicken pecks around the farmyard for food. Few people dare defy the mafia, except for an extraordinary 81-year-old grandmother who's doing just that. Nancy Greenlees tells her story in this reporter's notebook.
They call her the madrina, the godmother, but I'm adding fairy to her title. Pina Maisano Grassi has a pixie haircut and is so tiny that she barely passes my waist. She may be delicate, but she's a supernatural force when it comes to battling the mafia. We sit inside her elegant fabric store in Palermo, where I swear she has a sparkly godmother's wand tucked among the fabric bolts. Pina flitted into the lives of some young Palermo residents 5 years ago. Anonymously, they'd plastered the city with stickers that said, "A public that pays pizzo is a public without dignity." These young Sicilians were telling people to look in the mirror and see if they were helping to poison their society. Pina, already well known for her anti-mafia work, said a reporter asked her at the time if she knew who was behind the sticker campaign.
I said, "I haven't the faintest idea who did it, but if it was young people, they could be my grandchildren because they think exactly like me." And so the next day, three kids came into the store here and they said, "We're your grandchildren." And from that moment on, I started working with the kids behind Addio Pizzo.
That means goodbye pizzo. Those stickers launched the movement of mostly 20-somethings who go door-to-door asking business owners to pledge not to pay pizzo. More than 400 businesses have sworn to this anti-mafia oath. Pina knows firsthand the dangers of not paying pizzo. In 1990, mobsters came calling at her husband Libero's thriving clothing factory. They wanted a cut. He refused and decided to break the code of silence by reporting them to the police. But the intimidation continued. He was robbed, and even the family dog was stolen, returned later, nearly dead from starvation. Libero sought help from the local business association. The president accused him of seeking publicity and said the mafia didn't exist. Pina says then he wrote a letter to Sicily's leading newspaper.
This letter was addressed, "Dear Extortionist," and it said, "It's useless for you to continue to threaten me, ask me for my money, etc., or threaten to blow up my factory, or things of that sort, because I'm definitely not paying you."
7 months later, Libero was shot 3 times in the head outside his home. Pina posted a plaque where Libero was murdered that says the mafia killed him. But it adds that his death is also due to the absence of the government and the code of silence of the business association.
In fact, things didn't start to change until July of 2004, 13 years after Libero's murder, when Adio Pizzo launched and started taking action. The young people made it happen since they understood how important it was to revolt against the mafia and its bullying.
Pina also fights back, appearing at any and all events at which Adio Pizzo requests her presence. She gently, calmly encourages businesses to do what her husband did, report criminals. With the help of Adio Pizzo, now business owners who defy the mafia are given support and shown solidarity. As for her own safety, Pina says she hasn't been threatened by the mafia. It seems that she's become almost untouchable. So the godmother is taking down the godfather, yet she gives all the credit to the young people in Adio Pizzo. But they know, and Sicily knows, that her magic touch helped.
Nancy Greenlees is a freelance reporter based in Rome. This time for Africa. That's the official FIFA song for the 2010 World Cup tournament. But this sound is probably what fans are most familiar with. Coming up, we talk about what we heard during the World Cup in South Africa. Stay with us for that. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. South Africans mark every occasion, birth, death, marriage, even an ordinary business meeting, with song. It's just part of the culture. So it's no surprise that music has been an integral part of the 2010 Soccer World Cup in South Africa. And here to talk about the soundtrack to the soccer games is Tom Pryor. He's the world music specialist at National Geographic and editor of their world music website. Tom, great to talk to you again.
Thanks, Peggy. Thanks for having me on.
Let's jump right into the official song of the World Cup, and that's Shakira's song, Waka Waka, this time for Africa. What does Waka Waka mean?
Well, actually, Waka Waka has a really long and twisted provenance, and it's originally a song from Cameroon that was hit in the 80s that was critical of the military government there. And it's sung in, Waka Waka is actually in the Fong language of Cameroon, and it's kind of satirical about militarism. Now, it became transplanted a couple times and became a hit in Latin America, where Shakira heard it. Essentially, it's nonsense lyrics by the time her version came around.
Really? So it doesn't even make sense?
Not in this context. There's an old band called Zangawela from Cameroon who did it originally. It made sense in their context. But for her, it's just pop. It's, you know, it's fun words. It doesn't mean much. I mean, she has fun with it. It is of African origin, not exactly South African, which has kind of been a criticism of a lot of the World Cup music.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The choice of Shakira was pretty controversial. Why did FIFA, the International Soccer Association, choose a Colombian superstar for their big song?
Well, the short answer is that FIFA didn't. FIFA actually gave over the rights to Sony to make that decision. And to be fair, she's backed by a wonderful band from South Africa called Freshly Ground, who are a pop outfit from South Africa who've been around since the, I guess, the 90s. They're led by a wonderful singer called Zolani Mahola, and they sort of give it that background punch and that wonderful sort of township-sounding guitar.
Yeah, and they have great dancing backup, too.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do.
Now, part of the song that she sings, Waka Waka, is in English, and part of it, as you mentioned, is in this language from Cameroon. Is there a theme to this song? What is the song about?
Well, sure. I mean, the English part very explicitly demonstrates the theme, which is This Time for Africa. It's this theme of sort of talking about, it's the first African World Cup, obviously, but also the sort of celebrating this new, younger generation, this not just in South Africa, not just the post-apartheid generation, but the sort of millennial generation of African. I mean, it is the youngest continent on the planet. And this World Cup is supposed to showcase that to some degree. And I think it's successful in that respect as a song.
So what has the reception been to the Shakira song? Has it become a hit as a result of the World Cup?
To some degree. I think there was a lot of controversy early on, especially in South Africa, because they didn't really use a South African artist. And, you know, they sort of had this shotgun marriage of Shakira and Freshly Ground. Let's face it, these things always take a second place to gameplay as the tournament wears on. And as, you know, as the cup has progressed, they had the big opening pageant and, you know, they had all the artists come out and sing their songs at her. They had Kanaan, quite a few others. In fact, quite a few South African artists actually played that concert, including Yuma Sakela and some of the bigger names that we all know.
You mentioned Kanaan, and it seems like his song has, in a way, become the unofficial anthem. But it's the official World Cup song for Coca-Cola.
Exactly.
It's called right. Waving Flag. Maybe we should listen to a little bit about that, and then you can tell us why it's so popular.
Fire, give me reason, take me higher. See the champions, take the field now. Unify us, make us feel proud. In the streets, our heads are lifting. As we lose our inhibition, celebration, it surrounds us. Every nation, all around us. Sing forever young, singing songs underneath the sun. Let's rejoice in the beautiful game. And together at the end of the day, we all say, when I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag. When I get older, I will be stronger. They'll call me freedom, just like a waving flag.
You gotta love that song.
Oh yeah, and I think Coke scored a coup here, Coca-Cola. And I'm not sure what kind of corporate chicanery went on there and how Coke scored that song and FIFA and Sony missed out. But I think it really speaks much more to the theme of this cup. Just lyrically talking about, you know, getting stronger, being young and powerless, and then, you know, coming into your own. And I think that's really what this cup is about for South Africa and for Africa in general.
Yeah, it's so personal for Kanaan because he's from Somalia, and this is some of his own story, even though he's a Canadian artist now. And he didn't originally write that song for the World Cup.
That's right.
But what do you think he's talking about when he says, they'll call me freedom just like a waving flag?
I actually happen to know Kanaan, and we've talked about this, and the song is about 2 years old. It comes from his last record, and it's his very personal story. He was with some friends on a beach in Somalia before he managed to emigrate, and they were killed. They were murdered by some militia guys, which, you know, if you know Mogadishu, that can happen pretty easily.
Yeah.
So this song is about him really overcoming that, and. You know, turning the personal into, I'm not sure the political is the right word, but certainly into something larger than just his own story.
And I understand he even changed some of the lyrics to make them a little more soccer friendly. You talk about Shakira's as pop and fun and funky, and this one's pretty heavy.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we should emphasize he did re-record it with some more soccer pertinent and football friendly lyrics. But and I think that's what makes this song so strong is that it is about the cup, but it's also about this really personal story. And you know, street violence is by no means limited to Mogadishu in Africa. I mean, anybody in Guguletu or any of the townships, Soweto, can certainly identify with this hillborough in South Africa. So I think it's a little more resonant for a lot of people. And it's a really good song. It's a great song.
And you could certainly see in the opening concert for the World Cup when he sings this song, he clearly captures the entire audience. I mean,
yeah,
it makes you wonder why his song became the official song for Coke instead of for the whole tournament.
I wish I knew the backstory of that myself. It's got to be fascinating.
So many wars, settling scores, bringing us promises, leaving us poor. I heard them say, love is the way, love is the answer. That's what they say, but look how they treat us.
Okay, now I want to go to one of your favorite topics. And some people's most hated topic, the vuvuzelas. You cannot turn on the World Cup, any game, without hearing this constant crazy noise in the background. And we've heard so many stories about it that most people probably know what it is, these horns. It's kind of like the soundtrack for the World Cup.
It truly is.
What do you think about the vuvuzelas?
I'm of two minds. I like the excitement that it adds to the game. But I also, the part of me misses the songs that you get in the stands. I mean, it's, you know, really fun, clever little ditties that have always been a part of, all football, really, all soccer, but certainly in the World Cup, you know. And one criticism that really resonates with me about the vuvu is that it's a dumb instrument, in that people blow it at all times of the game, regardless of what's going on.
I know, it's nonstop, and it makes you wonder. When I'm watching, I think, doesn't this really distract the players? I guess they just get so used to it.
Well, yeah, and that's the idea is that, you know, with, for instance, those thunder sticks, that you do it at a crucial moment to sort of disrupt play a little bit. But they do it all the time, and you do miss those great cheers that you used to get and those wonderful chants and the songs.
Do you know what the background is for these obnoxious horns for listeners who might not have heard?
You know, there's a couple of stories kicking around, but sort of the official line is that they are a modern-day variant of the old something called a kudu horn. Well, kudu is an antelope, and in Zulu culture, these were used to hollowed out and blown to call people to sort of village gathering sort of things. That's a little dubious, but that's sort of the official line. The unofficial line is that these are they've been using similar horns in Mexico since the 1970s, originally made out of tin. A couple of South African impresarios, and there's some competing claims on this, so I don't want to give weight to either one. One goes back to the early 70s, another goes back to about the 80s, saying that they invented the vuvu, but then the South African Football Association banned the tin because it could be used as a weapon, so they came back with plastic ones. But the interesting thing is that they're all made in – 90% of vuvus are actually made in China.
We want to think they're so African and only to find out they're made in China?
They are indeed. Well, there is one company in South Africa that makes about 10% of them, and apparently it's worth about 4 billion rand a year, according to The Guardian, I was reading earlier, which is fascinating to me. And their orders have been placed by Russian teams. I know there were orders placed from Russia and I think Turkey. So the vuvu is coming.
It's coming into its own, and we're probably going to be hearing from these vuvuzelas after the games have ended, I would imagine.
That's right.
Tom Pryor is the world music expert for National Geographic. Tom, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The World Cup winds down after the final on July 12th, and South Africans go back to their normal lives after a month of excitement, partying, and international exposure. But has hosting the World Cup been a good thing for the people of South Africa? Reporter Ish Mafundukwa is there, and this is what he thinks.
When it was announced that South Africa would be the first African country ever to hold the World Cup, cynics and Afro-pessimists said the country would not pull it off. There was even talk of a plan B to move the tournament elsewhere should the country fail to build the required infrastructure in time. But South Africa has delivered what it promised: new roads, more buses and trains, and new communications networks. Not only that, it has had a very well-organized cup watched by a global television audience in record numbers. South Africans, and indeed Africans at large, say the tournament has helped rebrand the continent and proved that Africa is more than the disease, strife and hunger it has become synonymous with in the eyes of many. I, like the majority of Africans, rejoiced when the World Cup was awarded to South Africa. But when the multi-billion dollar cost of the whole thing sank in, I started to question the wisdom of holding the cup here. In fact, the success of this cup may yet return to haunt the South African government. 16 years after the first democratic elections here, the majority of people are still very poor, and the situation is actually getting worse. A recent United Nations report says that 43% of South Africans live on less than $2 a day, up from 34% in 2006. Shanty towns surround most of South Africa's rich cities. A few days ago, I visited Joza, a township on the outskirts of the town of Grahamstown. Here, some people live in structures made of pieces of metal sheets, while others live in huts made of poles and mud. There is no indoor plumbing. The residents use outhouses. I asked some of Joza's people what they think of their country holding the World Cup. Most of them are caught up in the euphoric tide that has swept this country, though they can't afford even the cheapest ticket to a game. But these people are all too aware that the cup will be just a memory in a few days. While most of them are full of praise for the government on the organization of the cup, it seems this very success has raised their expectations. They say if the government can come up with the money to put on a show the size of the World Cup, then surely it must have the resources to provide them with the very basic services that they have been denied so far. Soon, the state-of-the-art stadiums will empty out. Some may be used for other purposes, some may just become white elephants. But they will stand as a reminder to the people of Joza and other shantytowns across the country that now, it's their turn.
And it was the turn of hundreds of disadvantaged kids during the last week of the World Cup. Here's our globe at a glance. They came from all over, from the minefields of Cambodia to the slums of Nigeria and the inner cities of England. Hundreds of underprivileged young people descended on South Africa during the final week of the World Cup. But they're not there to watch the soccer. They're there to play it. Girls and boys between 15 and 18 duke it out on the soccer field, like the superstars playing in the World Cup stadiums across town. Unlike the superstars, these teams don't have referees. If a problem arises, play is stopped, and the young footballers resolve the issue themselves. The trip to the tournament is a reward for work they do to build better lives for their communities back home. The Football for Hope program is sponsored by FIFA, the world football governing body. They're partnering with civic organizations in 50 countries. The goal, no pun intended, is to celebrate the power of sport to influence positive social change. It's the first time the social aspect of soccer has been officially celebrated, and fittingly, at the first African World Cup in the sport's history. And that's our globe at a glance. I'm Peggy Waymire. And to bring us to the end of our African World Cup coverage and our show, here's the way fans around the world react when that ball makes it past the goalpost.
Goal!
Allah, 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 and yes, the Gattara, 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 Gattara.
The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Waldiga is the production assistant. And that's finally it from the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization. Welcome to